This is John Hockenberry. Thanks for downloading this podcast from The Takeaway, produced by WNYC and Public Radio International. We'd love for you to be a part of the conversation. Find and friend us at Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and there's more at thetakeaway.org. Here we go. Hope you enjoy the show. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And on the eve of a feast day, we have a thoughtful feast of ideas from a man who represents the idea of Thanksgiving on a global scale for a billion Catholics and to others who see the Pope as a key voice in the world conversation on charity, morality, and concern for all of the peoples of the world. Pope Francis this week released an 84-page theological manifesto articulating a mission to fight what he called the tyranny of unfettered capitalism, calling on world leaders to define themselves in the fight against poverty rather than on the battlefield. None of the world's problems can be addressed, he said, unless we attack the structural causes of inequality. Healthcare, education, and employment need to be opportunities for all the world's people. The radicalism of this pope is not a surprise, but his message did evoke for me a surprising Hollywood moment from a 1968 movie about a controversial imagined papacy during the Cold War. Anthony Quinn, playing the pope in the movie The Shoes of the Fisherman.
I am the custodian of the wealth of the church. I pledge it now. All our money, all our holdings in land, buildings, and great works of art for the relief of our hungry brothers.
Give all the Vatican's wealth away, a radical but easily dismissed thought in 1968, perhaps not so much today. How might we better understand this new message from Pope Francis? Joining us now is Reverend James Bretsky, professor of moral theology at Boston College School of Theology and Ministry. Reverend, welcome.
Nice to be with you, John.
So if we were to take this message from the Pope and really thoughtfully deconstruct it in the way that you think the Pope might want us to hear it, both Catholics and just people around the world, because this is a message to the world, how would you go about doing that?
Well, I would say instead of deconstructing it, I would say that it brings together, it constructs all of the things that he has been saying in one place or another, and it does it in a unified way. He's hitting the main themes about the gospel going out to all people, seeking out the marginalized, and that there has to be a new direction for the church. And he's doing this at a high level of authority. It's called apostolic exhortation.
What is the tradition of radicalism among Franciscans or Jesuits or, you know, these strands and themes within the Catholic Church that go back a long, long way? And how is he pulling on those here?
Jesuit radicalism, I think, focuses more on the person of Jesus Christ, making him the center of our lives and our spirituality, and trying to be explicitly gospel-oriented, to bring Christ to all people. And I think that that is what the Pope is doing. I think he's combining the Franciscan spirituality and the Jesuit heritage as well.
Pope John Paul II inherited a moment in history where he was able to confront essentially the entire Soviet Union with his view of religion and morality and Catholicism. And it immediately put him on a world stage. I'm wondering if Pope Francis here is more concerned with doing good works and making revolutionary change in small local areas around the world, in South America, in Africa, in places where the church is growing, as opposed to confronting the power structure as Pope John Paul II did.
Well, I think he's trying to confront the power structure like Pope John Paul II did in larger terms, but he's not a geopolitical figure. If you read the exhortation, as he goes through it, he quotes one region's bishops' conference after another, bringing out, well, this is what the bishops in the Philippines say, this is what the bishops in the United States say, and this is their take on the problems there. So I think he's trying to go more explicitly to the grassroots in the church to lift them up, to see them as change agents in the world, rather than say like going immediately to the United Nations or Barack Obama or Putin or people like that.
It's very interesting. Are you a movie buff, Reverend Bretsky?
Well, somewhat.
Do you remember this film from 1968, Shoes of the Fisherman?
Oh, yes, that one I remember very well.
And you remember the end where Anthony Quinn, is, as his first act as Pope, this controversial new Pope, basically says, we're giving all our money away?
I do remember that.
Are we living something like that? I remember back then that seemed like, oh, that'll never happen. But there's a sense of echoing and that we've come so far. I mean, it's not the movies, of course, but what do you think?
Well, I think that rather than the giving the money away, which once it's gone, it would be gone. I think where Pope Francis is like the Pope in the shoes of the fisherman is thinking outside the box and not coming through the normal ways that popes might find themselves promoted to office. He is really an outsider in that sense. He has been in Buenos Aires. He's been with the poor, and that's what he's brought to Rome.
A traditional doctrinal credibility, a sense of global populism because of his background in South America, and a little bit of social entrepreneur thrown in there for good measure. Is that a reasonable summing up?
Yes, I think that's a reasonable summing up, and I would just crown it with he is profoundly a man of prayer. I think he's a man in love with Jesus Christ, and that's what gives him joy. And so that will be the force of attraction and conversion in the world.
Reverend James Bretsky is professor of moral theology at Boston College School of Theology and Ministry. Reverend, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
So making the mission to eradicate poverty a central mission of government, humanity, of our economic system, it's a radical idea, but not so much if we focus on our own backyards. Even that can be daunting. Here in the U.S., 47 million Americans are on food stamps, and this year they'll be feeling cuts to the SNAP Assistance Program. That's the federal acronym for the food stamp program. Those cuts started at the beginning of this month. Are we going backwards? Well, listen to the Thanksgiving plans of Jennifer Peguero in the Bronx. She's struggling to stay off food stamps and can only afford Thanksgiving if she combines resources with her neighbors.
Since I'm no longer receiving food stamps, it's a little bit harder to sustain paying cash out of pocket and trying to be self-employed and trying to get myself going is very difficult. Jobs are hard to come by. When you do find one, usually they're short term. It's pretty hard in the market for me.
Where are you spending Thanksgiving?
At home.
How many folks will be at your table?
We're estimating three households. It'll be my three and self and approximately 12 people.
Meanwhile, 59-year-old Mary Coleman, a food stamp recipient out in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, definitely feels like she is going backwards.
It has gotten extremely hard, especially working a restaurant job where I make $7.25 an hour. And I do receive food stamps, but they have cutting it down over the times. And one is because I am working, they cut them down. And then the second time they cut them down was when they cut back on everyone's, you know, food stamps. So now I get like 119 in food stamps. And I get them the first part of the month. By the time the middle of the month comes, I'm scuffling for food.
So what are you not going to be getting for your Thanksgiving table this year that you might have been able to afford last year?
Well, hopefully, and I think for the Hungry Task Force, I am equipped.
You're equipped. So how many people are going to be at your table? Where are you spending Thanksgiving?
Well, it's myself, my two daughters, and my son, and my sister, two sisters. We're all together. We're doing like a potluck.
All right. And what are you bringing?
Well, thanks to Hungry Task Force, I got the turkey, you know, and some greens and the cornbread and the potato salad.
Mary Coleman, thanks so much and have a great Thanksgiving.
Okay, thank you guys, and I appreciate you listening to me.
None of this is a surprise to Joel Berg, executive director of the New York City Coalition Against Hunger and author of All You Can Eat, How Hungry Is America.
We know exactly what works in fighting hunger, and America has been doing precisely the reverse. We know that creating living wage jobs and ensuring an adequate safety net will end hunger in America as it has in much of the rest of the Western developed industrialized world, and yet we are killing all programs to create new jobs, and we're cutting back on the food stamps, the SNAP program, even though it reduces hunger and aids the economy.
And from your perspective, you know, the Pope says something like, if you're not solving poverty, if you're not giving opportunity and equality to all of your citizens, you're really not addressing any problem seriously. Is that the way you see it?
Oh, absolutely. When you look back at our time, 100 years from now, you're going to clearly see that inequality of wealth is the central defining issue of our time, and that Washington is absolutely failing in addressing it. In fact, they're making it worse. Only bright spot here in New York City is that we have a mayor-elect who's actually dedicated to doing something about it.
Do you think we're going backwards in the United States and in New York on the question of hunger and poverty?
There's no question we're going backwards. Look, every soup kitchen, food pantry, food bank, and food rescue group in America provides a total at most of $5 billion worth of food a year. We just cut the food stamps, the SNAP program, by $5 billion. It's as if we obliterated every charity in America for a year. And now Congress is considering another $40 billion in cuts. It's insane. It's hypocritical. We're spending ever more money on corporate agribusiness, corporate welfare. And we have to say that, boy, $1.50 a meal is too much for these fine folks.
Where will you be tomorrow?
I will be at home. A lot of people expect a hunger activist is going to be working, but actually Thanksgiving's the one day of the year where all the pantries and kitchens we work with actually have more than enough help.
And how many people around your table?
Two.
Two?
Two. We keep it small.
Keep it small. All right. Joel Berg, executive director of the New York City Coalition Against Hunger. Thanks so much. Some happier thoughts from you out there about your own Thanksgiving table. A little old-fashioned self-reliance from Salem, Oregon. Every year, an old friend and I roast the ducks that we hunt earlier in the season. Hunting my own food always makes me feel that much more proud of the outcome. Well, I hope the ducks taste good. Big table in Miami, Florida. In Miami, the mix of cultures rules. So if you're Cuban, it's all the traditional Thanksgiving dishes plus yuca con mojo, plantains, black beans, and rice. And a persistent mystery from Nashville, Tennessee. My grandmother, you write, always makes orange fluffy stuff each year. Being a vegan health nut, I won't go near it, although I love watching my relatives enjoy it, despite the fact no one knows a single ingredient that it contains. Orange fluffy stuff, dessert topping, or floor wax? You decide. We also got this call that speaks for many of you out there.
This is Garrett from Bloodshed, Indiana, and we are going to be having a very special addition to our Thanksgiving feast this year, potato latkes, as we celebrate Hanukkah on Thanksgiving night.
We'll hear more about the Thanksgivica phenomenon later this hour. It won't happen again for another 70,000 years. Will there even be another ice age? I alluded to that earlier. There might actually never be another ice age. We always want to hear from you and about what's on your Thanksgiving table. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Be a part of the conversation. Find us at facebook.com/thetakeaway. A case now of a divided community, perhaps finding clarity about an incident some were inclined to cover up and others wanted to make a national story over how a culture of tolerance for sexual violence can exist in a high school football program. Steubenville, Ohio, August 2012, a 16-year-old girl from a town just across the state line in West Virginia accuses two sophomore starters on the high school football team of rape. Some in the community said it was just a teenage party that got out of hand and no reason to besmirch the reputations of high school athletes. But eventually a judge declared two underage boys guilty of the juvenile crime of rape. And this week, a special grand jury addressed the question of who among the responsible adults in Steubenville might have allowed this to happen or tolerated what ended up happening in the school's football program. Four indictments handed up against the school superintendent, a former volunteer assistant football coach, and two teachers. We turn now to the chief law enforcement officer in the state of Ohio, Attorney General Mike DeWine. Mike DeWine, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Good to be back. Thank you very much.
How difficult is it for you as a state official to be a party to something that has so deeply divided an individual community, if you could be candid on this subject?
Well, it's interesting. Under Ohio law, we really have no jurisdiction here unless we're invited in. But we were invited by the prosecuting attorney. She felt there was a conflict within her office. She asked us to come in. And so we ended up prosecuting these two juveniles. And they, of course, as you mentioned, were found delinquent by reason of having committed a rape. At that time, I thought, though, that we really needed to get to the bottom of this. With all the social media and all the rumors and some facts that we had, I felt we needed to go further. So I asked the court to convene a grand jury. They did. They came in. These are citizens of Jefferson County, where Steubenville is located, just, you know, average citizens, and they did an amazing job. 18 days of testimony and work, 123 actual witnesses, 600,000 text messages that were at least available to that grand jury, and they came back, as you mentioned. This Monday, we announced the indictments. And I think really what the grand jury was meaning to do, and I think what they did, is to hold adults accountable. You know, how can you hold juveniles accountable if you don't also hold adults accountable?
I have to say, Mike DeWine, that, you know, you don't often see institutions of justice, political institutions in a state really attempting to grapple head on with such a controversy in a community. We recall this is a national story. How is this not a witch hunt and really an attempt to get closure within that Steubenville community?
Well, it took longer than I think anyone wanted it to take, but my commitment to the community was to get to the bottom of it, leave no stone unturned, and to find out what the facts are. And I think, you know, these individuals are entitled to their day in court. They are presumed innocent. The grand jury did find probable cause that they committed a crime. And I think what's interesting is there were a lot of people said, well, why, you know, why isn't this person indicted, or why wouldn't this be indicted? And there were all the social media, you know, there was just a lot of rumors and accusations against people. So in part, what we were doing is not only finding who we believe and the grand jury believes actually committed a crime, but also you know, trying to determine who didn't. And what I made clear on Monday is the community needs to move on at this point. If someone has not been indicted, that means there's not been enough evidence to prove that that beyond, you know, that they did this. The grand jury didn't think there was probable cause. So I think, in a sense, this should clear the air.
Mike DeWine, I have to say, you know, prosecutors and attorneys general go after, you know, white-collar criminals here in New York, you know, the low-hanging fruit, the murder cases that are going to get headlines. Why would you want to step into this under any circumstances? It seems to me the worst possible case politically in a state where high school football is absolutely huge.
Well, high school football is huge, and the Big Red team of Steubenville is actually now in the state semifinals. So it continues to be very, very big. But it's, you know, it's really not about football. It's about the truth. It's about holding people accountable. You know, we get asked, frankly, to do the tough cases.
All right, Mike DeWine, before we go, what do you think the message is for athletic programs in high schools around the nation, for young men and young women in high school thinking about those graduation parties or homecoming parties, and what is tolerated and what's not to be tolerated? And again, we're thinking presumption of innocence here, but still, what do you think the message is for people thinking about their own programs?
I think for the juveniles, it is, you know, take care of each other. What we saw with this young girl, no one was really watching out for her, or very few people were. Underage drinking occurs across the country. It's not unique to Steubenville. No one has the right to take advantage of someone who has passed out. And, you know, sex was treated, frankly, as a recreational activity in some cases, what we have found. I think the other lesson for adults who run these programs is these programs are important. There are many kids who really benefit from sports, and I'm a big sports fan myself, so we're not knocking sports, but we need to keep everything in perspective. And everybody is accountable, whether you're the football player, whether you're the cheerleader, or whether you're just a kid in school who goes to school. Everybody is accountable for their own actions, and it's up to people in authority to hold them accountable. The other thing we saw here, we believe, based on the allegations and based on, not the allegations, but based on what the grand jury came back with, is they charged some people with failure to report. In other words, teachers are mandatory reporters in the state of Ohio. If they believe, they have reasonable cause to believe a child is endangered, they have to report it. And part of our message in this is teachers have to follow the law. And if they have reasonable cause to believe that a child is endangered, they have to do what is not only morally right, but it's also the legal requirement in the state of Ohio.
Mike DeWine, Attorney General of Ohio, thanks so much, and have a great Thanksgiving.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
I'm Spartacus.
I'm Spartacus.
I'm Spartacus.
No more. Hang on.
I'm trying to use the phone.
Happy Thanksgiving, Spartacus. Yes, movie weekend. Thanksgiving weekend, the biggest movie release weekend. One of them, at least biggest in terms of days. Rafer Guzman, Kristen Meinzer are here with all the movies for this weekend. Rafer, of course, a film critic for Newsday. Kristen is culture producer for The Takeaway. Welcome, guys.
Hi, John.
Hi, John.
So let's start with, I guess it's a big history pick. It's not the first time that Nelson Mandela has been treated by Hollywood, but let's see what you think of Mandela. Here's a clip.
You are Nelson Mandela.
And you are Winnie Madikizela.
How do you know?
I made inquiries.
And what else did you find out?
That you work at Baragwanath Hospital. You are the first black social worker they've ever had. And you're the most beautiful girl I've ever seen.
So, Rafer, this is everything that Invictus was not in terms of treatment of history and the way they treat the subject.
As you can kind of hear from that clip, it's an information-packed life story of Nelson Mandela. He is alive, but it is almost cradle to grave, this story. I think it's a nice attempt. Idris Elba, who plays Mandela, is really good. He's great in the role. You can kind of see this inner life that he has. I just feel it's a bit of an Encyclopedia Britannica entry. It's less of a story. It kind of unrolls in this outrush of facts, and you never kind of really get to feel for the drama of the movie.
Movie house or study hall, Kristen?
You know, I have to agree with Rafer on this one, and I do have to go back to something that you mentioned, John. Invictus is actually a better movie if you want to know Mandela, I think.
It's a Hollywood movie.
Yeah,
it's so Hollywood.
But what we get in this movie is trying to get every single fact, every single moment, and I think just focusing on a few moments would have made this a stronger movie rather than get everything in there.
One of the things I love about this weekend movie-wise is on Black Friday, you can see Black Nativity, which is an ambitious movie using the Langston Hughes libretto. Let's hear a clip.
Choose for yourselves this day which God you will serve. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord.
So, Kristen, that, of course, Forrest Whitaker, one of my favorite actors. How does this go?
I always love Forrest Whitaker, but the real star in this is Jennifer Hudson. This is an estranged daughter with her father, who's a reverend, with her son. She's a single mom. And it's a little small Christmas parable, a sweet little Christmas movie that really, I think, would have been better as a one-hour television special. And trying to turn it into a feature-length film, It kind of lags at certain moments, but every time Jennifer Hudson is on screen, she is fantastic.
Well, artistically, Langston Hughes has been, the ambition of a lot of producers and directors and writers in Hollywood. This is just another attempt, but he's a difficult material for, the standard sort of movie fare. What would Thanksgiving weekend be without Disney? What's the offering this time around, Rafer?
This is Frozen. It's a fittingly wintry tale. It's about the kingdom of Arendelle. It's been trapped in eternal winter. You've got a young princess, Anna, who's riding out on a journey to solve the problem. Of course, she meets a sidekick, a snowman, and of course...
A talking snowman,
that's right.
And, not Burl Ives, right, Kristen?
That's right.
And I have to say that this movie was fantastic.
And let's hear from the talking snowman.
Oh, I don't know why, but I've always loved the idea of summer and sun and all things hot.
Really? I'm guessing you don't have much experience with heat.
Nope.
You love that. That's Josh Gad as Olaf, the snowman in Frozen.
Yes, that's right. He's the sidekick. He's going to help the princess lift the kingdom from eternal winter.
You loved?
Loved it.
All right.
One of the best movies of the year.
One of the best movies of the year from Rafer and Kristen. Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. Kristen Meinzer, culture producer for The Takeaway. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, John.
So, Kristen Meinzer, before you head out for Thanksgiving, let's actually give people a taste of the Movie Date podcast. I'm actually pretty jealous you got to speak with the multi-talented star of Frozen, Josh Gad.
Yeah, he's absolutely wonderful. Broadway star who many people know best as Elder Cunningham from the Book of Mormon. In this movie, he plays talking snowman Olaf, who wants to do anything he can. He'll sacrifice anything in order to help his friends lift their kingdom from eternal winter. And he's just wonderful.
The idea is that he is a child. It's that these two girls created this snowman at a time in their lives where they were at their purest and most innocent before things got complicated for them. And so he's the last remnant of that innocence. He's the last remnant of that joy and that hope that was still there before adversity came into their lives. And so I really tried to infuse him with that sense of youthful optimism, with that sense of naivete that, you know, kids seem to have, where it's just all bright-eyed and, you know, the possibilities are endless. And he represents that hope. He represents that connection to that time to hopefully bring these sisters back, you know, to that moment when they were happiest.
Now, I have to ask a question. For me, but somebody asked me to ask you.
Uh-oh.
Did you draw any inspiration from Frosty the Snowman when you were preparing for this role?
Frosty was a great influence on me. he and I sat down. We had a heart-to-heart. he gave me some tips, and I some of them I listened to, others I didn't. No, Frosty is one of those characters that is – he is the essence of snowman. When people think of – snowmen, they think of Frosty. It's always the way it's been. So the fact that Olaf is even being thrown into that sentence alongside of him is really it's incredible. I hope that character, my character, remains as timeless as his is.
Now, I have to say, there are a lot of really well-intentioned films for kids that are still just painful as an adult to sit through. And some of the messages in the films I find really disconcerting, even films that are supposed to be feminist that don't come off that way. And something I really loved about this movie is I felt that I could show it to my niece, or you have a daughter where you could show it to her and not feel at all like the main goal or the main meaning in the female characters' lives is I must get married, I must be kissed by my true love, this is the way we're going to live happily ever after. But there are such other more important things that complete us as humans that are a part of this story. And it just, to me, made such a difference in my experience as a grown-up watching it.
Well, I absolutely agree. I think it's one of the most empowering feminist animated stories that I've ever seen. And I also think that there's something miraculous about what the storytellers have achieved, because it's taking this fairy tale paradigm that we're so accustomed to and flipping it on its head a little bit, you know, so that the meaning of true love is different than you expect it to be. There are these twists and turns along the way that I don't think a lot of the audience ever sees coming. And I think that it somehow feels traditional in the best sense of that word, yet modern at the same time without doing any sort of wink-wink pop cultural references. And I think that that's a remarkable achievement.
Will your daughter be seeing this?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Do you think she'll be confused at all? Daddy, that's your voice and that's a snowman.
No, in fact, I took her to see Monsters University in the theater. And I hadn't told her that I was in a movie. I didn't think she'd understand the concept. And just my laugh came on. It was one of that teaser with the snowman and the reindeer. And I didn't have any dialogue. And she literally looked at me and she goes, "That's Dada. More Daddy? More Dada?" And I couldn't believe it. I literally was like, "Yeah, that's Daddy." And then I turned away and started sobbing uncontrollably.
Oh, God.
She loves me so much. So it was... It's incredible to be able to share that with her. And then I've got another daughter on the way.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. So it's the fact that they're going to be sisters is also really interesting considering what Frozen's about and the parallel there. And it's something that I feel like I'll be able to share with them for many years to come.
Well, we're so glad to have you in. And
thank you.
So glad we got to share a little bit of time with you. Thank you.
I really
you.
Appreciate that. Thank you so much.
Josh Gad as Olaf the Snowman in Frozen in theaters today. And where can we get hear that entire interview, Kristen?
At moviedatepodcast.org, as always.
Great. Have a happy Thanksgiving, Kristen.
Thanks, John. You too.
So one of our Thanksgiving traditions here at The Takeaway is to remind America that like everything that happens in the U.S. economy, it is a projection of politics at some level. You may just feel like a lone voter, but every morsel on your Thanksgiving plate may have a lobbyist, folks. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, says a lobbyist busy wielding power in Washington.
This Thanksgiving, your relatives are dying to tell you what they think about politics. And lucky for you, there's a lot to talk about around the table. Obamacare, gay rights, Iran, Israel. Sounds like fun, right?
Mm.
Well, I, Todd Zwillick, and we here at The Takeaway offer you an alternative to the partisan sniping. We're here to help you school your relatives with some real Thanksgiving table talk about how real politics works. Let's get started with some true life scenarios. Uncle Bob says Obamacare is the worst thing since slavery. You can tell him you think it's pretty interesting that Congress can't agree on a $1 trillion farm bill. Meanwhile, did he know that the guys who bring the turkeys to the White House for pardoning every year are actually power players in Washington?
They are being presented today by the chairman of the National Turkey Federation.
Yep, the National Turkey Federation has already spent $125,000 funding 36 congressional candidates this year. And it's not even an election year. In fact, in the 2012 election, the Turkey Federation, chicken producers, Butterball, Tyson Foods, Hormel, and the National Chicken Council combined for over $600,000 in campaign contributions. So tell Uncle Bob that the chicken and turkey producers also happen to be fighting to prevent good business practice regulations from taking effect in the farm bill.
Well, I could use a drink.
Oh, so could I.
As long as Uncle Bob wants to talk health care, alcohol is a major driver of medical costs. Just ask any insurance company. Nothing wrong with all these beverages you brought over, Bob, but do keep in mind that the wine and spirits wholesalers of America have already raised $920,000 this year for politics. In 2012, they raised over $2 million, and the National Beer Wholesalers, $1.4 million doled out to 271 congressional candidates. That's over half the Congress in a non-election year. Well, here's another scenario. Cousin Merle passes the butter, but not before making it clear that the Tea Party wants to destroy the economy just so they can blame the whole mess on Obama. Does Cousin Merle holding the butter know that the dairy farmers of America spent $430,000 in 2012 and $130,000 so far this year on favored candidates? Oh, and that stalled farm bill just happens to include a massive dairy pricing program with a big impact on milk producers. Of course, all your aunts, uncles, and cousins already know that agriculture producers of all kinds are major drivers in the push for immigration reform. Cheap turkey, cheap chicken, potatoes, and fruit all require cheap labor, and all on a seasonal basis, if you can get it.
They're not as good as they used to be, I hear.
Nothing's as good as it used to be.
Except money! Money!
Yes, we've said it before, the Thanksgiving table is plentiful and delicious and absolutely riddled with political influence. But just one final note. There's no need to use your new arsenal of statistics just for defense. If you feel like going on offense, how about this? That farm bill debate we've been talking about also contemplates between $4 and $40 billion in cuts to the federal food assistance program. The 50 million Americans who rely on food stamps at least part of the year would love to know you're debating that at the table. And they don't have a pack.
I love that, Todd. You know, I think we should print out a Thanksgiving menu every year with all the ingredients and the contributions on them. And it could be like a gift from The Takeaway, don't you think?
Well, I have to tell you, such a menu does exist because for reasons I don't quite understand myself, ever since I kind of came up with this idea, I've been posting these different lobbying amounts on Twitter. So if you follow along while the White House turkey's being pardoned, you can find out for yourself. How's that for a menu?
Well, we want to thank the Center for Responsive Politics and its website, opensecrets.org, for providing all the campaign finance data you heard in this report, including the fact that the butter people are kind of cheap. Those numbers aren't very big.
No, except keep in mind these PACs that I mentioned are only just getting started. This is not an election year yet, and the reporting goes in 2-year cycles. So they have a long way to go between this year and when the primaries and the candidates start getting ramped up for next year to really slather the money on if they want to. And John, it's everybody. We talked about the food, of course, because that's Thanksgiving. But any other part of your Thanksgiving, the big box stores on Black Friday, lording money over candidates, of course. And, you know, if you want to talk about driving to grandma's house, gasoline, airlines, I mean, that won't surprise you at all to know that they're major players.
Now, the conspiracy theorists will say that Black Friday was invented by companies that lobbied politicians to make it an official holiday. Of course, Black Friday is just something that capitalism invented all on its own, right?
It is, but there are theories about daylight savings, too, if you want to know how that affects the economy. We can do a segment on that.
You can do Thanksgiving, Valentine's Day.
Sure.
All these holidays, have a market-based incentive. I'm wondering if Pepto-Bismol or antacids have a lobby. Because sometimes people really need those. After
John, last year when we did a version of this segment, if you scroll back, I don't know if you care to, we covered the pharmaceutical companies that make consumer pharmaceuticals, the ones you buy at CVS without a prescription. You bet they're players to the tune of hundreds of thousands of dollars. These are the big boys that make those products.
Todd, our listeners are journalists in their own right, citizen journalists, we call them. And I just want to play for you some evidence that maybe the spirits lobby and the cranberry lobby have united in some sort of coalition. Listen.
This is Jessica, and I'm calling from Portland, Oregon. My signature Thanksgiving dish is a homemade cranberry sauce, and it is made with so much alcohol that it should never be placed near candles or other open flames.
What do you think, Todd?
I appreciate that. I think that it's futile. Nobody can beat my own mother's cranberry sauce, which is a combination of the cranberry lobby, the orange peel lobby, and the sugar lobby, and it's absolutely delicious and unbeatable.
And is that your favorite dish? And are you going to be doing the Hanukkah Thanksgiving?
I haven't come up with the mashup there. It is absolutely my favorite dish. Look, I don't have a whole lot of mixture going on because I'm going to be in the car driving to relatives. But I did ask my sister, and she's got my niece and nephew at work right now doing a whole art display on Thanksgiving Hanukkah mashups. The drawings are actually coming in on my email as we speak, and we're going to make sure they're posted on the website because those kids are cute and their drawings are even cuter.
Well, have a happy Thanksgiving or Thanksgivica, Todd.
Thanks, John. You too.
Share your story at 8778MyTake. Follow us on Twitter at The Takeaway, all one word, at The Takeaway. And coming up, more on your Thanksgiving feast, and Hanukkah begins tonight. We celebrate the rare and magical mashup of the two holidays, Thanksgivica. This is The Takeaway.
Applesauce versus sour cream. Applesauce or sour cream. It's the choice you're gonna have to make. Which to put on your potato cakes. Applesauce versus sour cream. Applesauce.
One hardly needs an excuse, but in truth, I have to say I'm kind of surprised that American culture hasn't already gone here.
I always cooked a turkey in November. I lit my 8 menorah candles in December. But now my schedule's a mess. Because Hanukkah's tired. To Thanksgiving.
Now everybody's like pilgrims, Indians, readers of the Torah, Puritans, Wampanoag, dancers of the horror. We don't care. We're celebrating Thanksgiving.
It's just one of the viral musical entertainments celebrating in cheap humor and high-minded culture the fact that Hanukkah and Thanksgiving coincide this year. It's the last time this is set to happen for more than 70,000 years. Maccabees and mashed potatoes, dreidels and drumsticks. This is 2013. Deb Perlman is a blogger and author of the Smitten Kitchen Cookbook. She's with us with tips for how to celebrate this year's Thanksgivica at your own table. Deb, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
So do Hanukkah and Thanksgiving actually speak, since they do coincide in the calendar, in cuisine terms here?
I think that they meet at apples.
and they meet at Potatoes. I think there's a lot of that in both holidays, but that's about it.
Although that's pretty good. I mean, potatoes are huge in Thanksgiving. There are many sort of iterations of potatoes. Let's talk about some classic Hanukkah potato Thanksgiving iterations, if you could.
Well, you know, the big Hanukkah treat is always latkes, or at least it was in my family, which are those potato pancakes made with onion and fried until your apartment smells for a week. I've definitely been seeing a lot of references. I think if you are even remotely Jewish or sometimes are Jewish, you are going to see a lot of sweet potato latkes this year. But I also saw some versions I thought would be fun, which are more using the Thanksgiving vegetables, Brussels sprout latkes. And I saw one with parsnips. I've made parsnip latkes before. They're really delicious.
They would be good. That sounds good.
I do it with like a horseradish creme fraiche, which I think would be really nice.
Fantastic.
They're really great flavors together. And you could do it with carrots. You could use your Thanksgiving traditional vegetables to make your latkes this year.
Now, why would the turkey be like not a terribly Hanukkah-esque kind of thing?
I don't know. I feel like brisket is such a big thing in Judaism. So is lamb. So there are a lot of other, you know, so you could try to apply Hanukkah to turkey. I've seen Manischewitz brined turkey. I'm not sure how
using
that would
kosher
be.
Wine to yes. brine the turkey. Okay.
Yeah, maybe. I would imagine it would come out a little gray. I saw that on BuzzFeed. But who knows? It could be really good. Or you could try to apply, you know, the Thanksgiving idea maybe to your brisket with stuffing.
Well, the stuffing, I mean, you can do anything. You could stuff the turkey with brisket. You could stuff the brisket with turkey.
Exactly.
You could stuff the brisket with potatoes. You could stuff the brisket with rice. I mean, there's all kinds of combinations.
And I'm of the mind that stuffing belongs every day of the year and not just on Thanksgiving. It's a delicious, you know, savory side dish to any meat. So,
I mean, what if back at the original Thanksgiving there in Massachusetts or wherever, you know, a couple of rabbis showed up?
What would happen? I don't know. Would you have pumpkin challah?
There have been more jokes. There would have been many more jokes.
Maybe a little lighthearted.
That's for sure.
Bad jokes. Maybe a little more guilt.
Absolutely. Possibly.
Maybe we would have felt more terrible about the things that we did that got us to Thanksgiving.
So, right. Reminding ourselves that Yom Kippur was a few weeks ago. So, you know, we can atone on Thanksgiving. And everybody atones the day after Thanksgiving because you eat too much, right?
Exactly. That's the diet plan start. But then the cookies come in from the holidays. So forget it.
There's a lot of intersections there, Jewish and non-Jewish. So let's talk about the fruit side of this here. Traditional fruits for Thanksgiving, cranberries. You mentioned apples.
Mm-hmm.
What are the potentials there?
See, I think when you get over to the sweets, it can be really fun. I love the idea of an apple cranberry compote or apple cranberry sauce for your latkes if you're in the latke with applesauce camp. I mean, cranberries are just so wonderful and tart, and they're vibrantly red. And it's a color you don't see so much in fall and winter, other fruits and vegetables where things get a little flatter. So I love that idea, and I've also seen the idea of using cranberry sauce or cranberry jam to stuff those jelly donuts. I think cranberry sauce would be wonderful over a cake. I actually made myself pumpkin pecan arugula a few weeks ago to try to audition some mashup holidays. They were definitely tasty. They disappeared quickly. But I think if I was making them again, I might try to do a cranberry orange jam in there because I like that tart thing against the buttery cheese pastry.
Well, the tart thing in the arugula means that you can eat them all day long.
That's actually part of the problem for me.
and if it's just all if it's all pumpkin, I mean, you get four and then you're sick. Back to the stuffing idea. Mm-hmm. I mean, it would probably be excessive to stuff a turkey with latkes, but you could stuff a turkey with challah bread.
I've definitely seen that. And I also saw somebody suggested using onion bagels. And I was like, if you like your stuffing more savory, that would be a nice way to apply it. But I think challah would be wonderful. Or a blend of that heavy, you know, sour almost bagel flavor and the sweet tender challah, I think would be a delicious stuffing.
Now, as a cook, would you recommend allowing the bagels or the challah to get stale, to get dry out so that it's not too moist inside a turkey?
I think so. If the bread is too fresh, I would toast it. But bread, natural, if you just leave it out for a day, it's going to get stale anyway. So I might just leave it out and just let it happen. And bagels,
so do the same
course.
Thing. Make cubes of bread, allow them to either toast or get a little dry. dried out, and that'll make a better sandwich.
And bagels will do you that favor because no Jew is going to eat a bagel on the second day anyway. So
that's right. But if you do a third day on the bagels, you know, you've got rocks.
You're going to need a lot of extra stock to moisten it. But I would eat challah stuffing regardless on Thanksgiving. I think it sounds really good.
Any use for matzo balls?
I have a friend who made actually for a Hanukkah Thanksgiving early party. She made a apple pumpkin soup with matzo balls in it. And it was really neat. I think there are a lot of ways you could go with that. You could do maybe a turkey soup, you know, maybe use a turkey stock and some of the Thanksgiving vegetables in there and the little matzo balls too. It was really nice.
Well, obviously a lot of potential here. An aesthetic question before we go. As adults, we here are having a conversation as though the coinciding of Hanukkah and Thanksgiving is sort of additive. It kind of builds a sense of community between Jews and non-Jews on a holiday that's very national, on a relatively minor Jewish holiday, but still it's a lot of fun, which is what the Hanukkah is. And what is the combination we're calling it? Thanksgivica?
I've seen that. Yeah. It's a little hard. It doesn't come off the tongue easily.
No, it doesn't. But from a kid's perspective, when two holidays coincide, for a kid, it's kind of like subtracting.
Mm-hmm. Because it's less celebration.
Right.
Well, you know, Jewish kids still have 7 more days in which they can lure gifts out of their family. They might actually get extra presents on that first night because they're going to have their whole extended family there who they may not celebrate every night of Hanukkah with. So you might get a few extra gifts.
And just in terms of Hanukkah tradition, an extra cupcake at the Thanksgiving table doesn't count as one of the gifts.
No, that does not. Don't even try it.
Don't even
We're going to need at least one like automated car or train set.
Well, let's talk in 70,000 years or so when this happens again.
Yeah. I hope we're still here.
Deb Perlman, author of The Smitten Kitchen Cookbook on the fact that Thanksgiving and Hanukkah coincide. The two holidays won't collide for another 70,000 years. Let's share some menus. Las Vegas, Nevada, Chipotle sweet potato croquettes. My great-granddam made them for us great-grandkids, my son insists. It's not Thanksgiving without them.
My name is Christine, and I'm from Queens. We're from Jamaica, and we have adopted Thanksgiving, and we love this holiday, but we cannot have a Thanksgiving without having rice and peas. While we're celebrating our new culture and embracing it, it brings us back to home, and we know that we have a lot to be thankful for because we really love being in this country.
Eat those rice and peas and eat that crab stew down there in Pensacola, Florida. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway. Safe travels. Happy Thanksgiving, everyone.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.